continues to exploit African resources, uncovering labor violations by corrupt politicians and Western government powers. Learn what's happening now in interviews with artists, activists, scholars, and a host of other experts each episode. Listen Wednesdays at 1 p.m. Africa Now is also available on iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, as well as SoundCloud on your station for Jazz and Justice, WPFW, Washington.
Trump campaigners are reveling at the election returns that put Donald Trump as the 57th president of the United States. Although there are still votes to be counted, there is no path to the White House for Vice President Kamala Harris. Good morning. Special edition of What's at Stake, the post-election analysis, the morning after. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Well, the results are in. Donald Trump is will be the 57th president of the United States, 47th president of the United States. Hundreds of thousands of, there were 168.31 million registered voters in 2020, and of course, hundreds of thousands more signed up for this election. This morning, we're going to take a look at how voters in the battleground states performed with retired political science professor and former radical activist Dr. Claude Barnes. Black male voters were said to be reluctant to support Vice President Kamala Harris. Dr. Andra Gillespie will let us know if that was a widespread myth or an unfortunate reality. And there were the undecideds, the independents. Which way did they sway? Or did they decide to sit out on this arguably most important election in our nation's history? Dr. Wilmer Leon will tell us, give himself an independent, will give us the 411 on undecideds. Political consultant Robert Creamer, husband of U.S. Representative Jan Schakowsky of Illinois, himself a veteran political consultant, will give us his perspective on what we can look forward to or what we can expect in the next 4 years. Good morning. Good morning, all. Good morning, all.
Morning.
Morning.
Now, Robert, you have been organizing and consulting for the Democratic Party since 1970 or so. So I think it's safe to say you've seen one or two or maybe 14 or so of these elections. How many actually, do you know right off how many you've had?
Oh, I can't tell you right off.
Okay.
It's
that number.
It is a tragic morning.
Tragic.
For America.
Yeah, what are your thoughts about what happened?
Potentially for much of the world. We're going to have to do what we did in 2016 in many ways, and organize a second resistance to Trump's attempts to de-democratize America even more than it is. We yet to know whether Democrats will control the House. That would be a big help if we could. It's nip and tuck whether that's possible. We won't control the Senate, we're going to have to organize like never before to defend democracy in America and to prevent the harms that could very well result from a Trump presidency. I will say that I think the fundamental lesson here, because the campaign, in many respects, was executed very, very well, and the field operations were enthusiastic. We really worked hard to get votes out. But I think the fundamental lesson here is that there is a large number of Americans who feel like they're dispossessed by the system of America. I mean, the economic system more than anything else, but they translate that into the political system. And that we're going to have to do kind of organizing and focus on ending the kind of income inequality and difficulty that ordinary people have at succeeding that I think underlay much of the appeal of Trump. A lot of folks out there like the idea he just wants to tear things down and is a victim, like they feel. And that's a serious problem for us going forward. We have to address. One quick other thing. Some of the polling that our firm was involved in and did demonstrate that in those battleground states, a more populist message, and by that I don't mean right-wing populist, I mean economic populist message, mm-hmm. would have been more effective at winning.
We'll look more closely at which demographics did turn out for her, for Kamala, and which ones supported Trump. We do know that Republicans and their wealthy allies pumped, I don't know how many millions of dollars into this race over the last 2 weeks alone. And it's looking like that may have paid off. What are your thoughts about the money that was really just sort of shoveled into this campaign at the last minute? Does that really influence voters?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's a matter of communicating their message over and over and over. I think that has an influence. You know, money in politics is a huge problem in America. And that's one of the things we could have fixed if we had had a trifecta. And one day we're going to have to fix that. But now we're going to have to hunker down and prevent terrible disasters, assure there's another Democratic election, both for the Congress and the presidency, and come back. Hi, sorry for the dead air here. Verna, are you?
There are still some votes left to be counted. But there's absolutely no path to the White House. Is that accurate? I mean, regardless of what's left.
I believe that's accurate, yes. Wisconsin went for Trump, to my great surprise, I will say. Pennsylvania, North Carolina, Georgia. I mean, between all of those, it would be a practical impossibility for her to get 270 electoral votes. You know, one of the undemocratic elements in our politics, of course, is the Electoral College that makes people's votes in Wisconsin or Pennsylvania or whatever have more power than the votes of people in California or Tennessee. And that we have to address changing that as well. I will say, though, this appears to be the case that Trump may very well have a majority of the popular vote. Which is
This is looking as though he's got the popular vote as well. What do you think actually happened? Were you surprised by this type of loss? I mean, I don't even think you can characterize this as a close loss. What, your thoughts on that? You're the veteran.
It's close in terms of total numbers in each of these states and nationally, but I was surprised. I really did believe that we had the momentum going into this election. Both because women so fundamentally, you know, went with us, and also because we had a far superior field operation. You know, this is about people feeling like if things aren't right, they're going to throw the current government out. This is about being outsider, not the insider, and that came through more than I think we had expected.
You know, you said women, we had the women, but there were about 10 initiatives or on the ballot for abortion, and mm-hmm. I think 7 out of the 10 were passed.
Right.
You know, the one in Florida failed.
Failed because it didn't have majority. It failed because it required 60% of the vote and they only got 58. So, you know, it
was close to passage. But that sort of gave women an opportunity to vote for the passage of that abortion bill and not necessarily vote for Kamala if they chose to split it like that.
It'll be very interesting to get the post analysis of that. And and just see exactly how many women are like that. I agree. That'll be a very interesting question. In general, we thought that would get the vote out, and that could very well be the case. But we have to do some analysis to determine that. Mm-hmm.
So the next 4 years will be pretty difficult for Democrats, particularly since the Senate control has now been passed over to Republicans, and it's still yet to be seen who will have control of the House.
And I would say it'll be difficult for the American people. I mean, in an odd sort of way, our ability to message to the American people and mobilize them will be easier on the outside than the inside. But because if you're unhappy with the way things are, you want to take it out on the people in power. But it could be a tragedy for the American people in so many ways. And that's why we have to organize like never before for the next 2 years. And then we hope we'll take back the House and Senate, and then the next 4 years. By the way, the next midterm, the Senate is much more difficult map for the Republicans. All their seats are up next time. And whereas in this case, our seats were the ones that were up. And so hopefully we'll be able to retake the Senate next time. As you say, we get to find out who's going to control the House of Representatives. But, we really have to stress the underlying, we have to understand the underlying causes of people's feelings that go with a person who is unhinged and a bully, has all these traits this man has. And I think the fundamental thing we have to understand is that for a lot of Americans, things are not so good. And they take it out on what they consider the coastal elites, and instead of where they need to go, which is corporations and banks and the fact that three families control as much wealth as 50% of the balance of the population.
Robert Kramer, political consultant. In the battleground state of North Carolina, nearly 500,000 more citizens registered to help decide who will live in the White House for the next 4 years. There were 16 electoral votes up for grabs. Dr. Claude W. Barnes hails from North Carolina. He has a strong and long and storied career as a radical activist. Dr. Barnes, North Carolina historically leans Republicans. It's the only battleground state Trump won in 2016, and he won it again last night. What is it about Trump's message that appeals to the majority of North Carolinians, Dr. Barnes? Have you unmuted yourself, Dr. Barnes? Okay.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Okay, yes, we can.
Yeah, first of all, I don't think North Carolina is unique as far as what happened in this last election. It was called a swing state, but I'm not sure if that's an accurate depiction. And if you look at the results, North Carolina basically followed the line that most of the people followed in the United States. Part of the problem is, I think, the way we conceive of the nation as a whole. We think that we're a democracy. I call it something else, a neo-democracy. And I think we underplay the role that some other factors contribute to Trump's victory. Because it's not just Trump, it's Trumpism. It's not just that people don't like Trump. A lot of people don't like Trump, but they like what he represents. He represents, I'm sure you've heard this before, misogyny. He represents racism. He represents an ideology that supposedly puts America first. He represents a number of the, what I call, retrograde aspects of the American experiment. So people for a long time have been tired of civil rights, and in fact, we're in this, what I call, a post-civil rights era. Just like what happened after the Civil War, there was something called Reconstruction And then there was something called the post-Reconstruction era, what they call redemption. In my mind, we're in a similar period where civil rights is no longer at the top of the scale, but other issues have taken over, moved to the top of the scale.
Well, let me ask you this, Doctor.
As far as what happened in the election, I think you got to look at the polls. A lot of people think the polls are accurate and they represent science. In fact, the polls are inaccurate. They represent an art more than a science. And you could see how the polls have been wrong for a long period of time. They were wrong in 2016. They were wrong in 2020. They were wrong in 2022. They're wrong in obviously 2024. Everybody predicted this was going to be a tight race. In fact, it was a landslide. But I know I'm supposed to talk about North Carolina, but I had to make those introductory
comments. Well, let me ask you, Dr. Barnes, Obama was able to take North Carolina in 2008. How do you think his message differed that much from that of Kamala? And did you see, was it the same type of action or energy around Kamala's campaign in North Carolina that was around Obama's in 2008?
I think what happened with Obama was an outlier. This happens every now and then where you have somebody that breaks away from the normal progression in politics. So Obama was basically an outlier. The same thing I would say about Jimmy Carter when he won in 1976. So in my mind, Obama did not do anything significantly that was different from what Kamala Harris did. Unfortunately, hope you don't get this wrong, but Kamala was a Black woman. And on top of that, her identity was in question by a number of people in America. So she had a number of problems as far as the American electorate is concerned. Again, I think we put too much weight on the fact that America has moved away from its problem. In fact, these problems are still here. And Kamala's race, I think, brought it to the head of the table.
I'm going to take that up with Dr. Andre Gillespie when we get to her. But let me ask you, do you think enough effort was made to court the vote in North Carolina by the Harris campaign?
I think they had a good ground game. They had support from some of the community organizations. Get a lot of support from the churches, especially the Black churches. There was something called the Moral or Poor People's Movement that was led by William Barber, who's no longer in the state, but he has the infrastructure that's still here. So the ground game was about as good as you could probably get, but it could not overcome these basic problems that people have. A lot of Black men, unfortunately, are still misogynist. They don't want to see a Black woman in a position of power. That's a problem. Same is true with white men. Can't have problems with a woman being in a position. They might not express it, but that is a reality in this country. We haven't gotten over the problem of misogyny. We haven't gotten over the problem of racism. And we're in a period that I call the post-civil rights period. And then people talk to generational issues. A lot of young people have no memory of Jim Crow. They certainly don't have no memory of what happened in Nazi Germany. And another problem is connected to that. People don't have a good knowledge of history, or they got what I call historical amnesia. Because if you remember what Trump was doing during those 4 years in office, he had a horrible 4 years. You're talking about someone during the pandemic that was telling people to take bleach and Lysol to cure this problem of COVID, when in fact it ended up having millions of people healed or severely injured or what have you. But this never came up in a debate at all in terms of his response to the pandemic. So I think those are some of the problems that has to be done in the future, not just these issues of the ground game, had a good ground game, but some of these other issues they could not get a handle on.
Mm-hmm. And were you surprised by the results, Dr. Barnes?
No, I'm sorry, but I was pretty sure that Trump was going to win because I thought the polls were not actually measuring what was going on in the country. I was surprised by the magnitude of the win. I didn't think it was going to be such a landslide in the Electoral College, but I wasn't that surprised that Trump was going to win. I was, of course, hopeful that would not occur. I was very hopeful, but you know, hope doesn't decide what happens in an election. We got to focus on some issues. Well, so I think those are the problems that we have that have not been addressed. The problem of ideology. We live in a country where racism is still the dominant ideology, still a dominant way of thinking. So we've got to find a way to overcome still the problem of racism. It expresses itself in different ways. And I used to tell my students, well, the science has come down, but how much has changed? Not very much has changed. People are a lot more civil in some ways, but the treating other people as second-class citizens still exists. So you can look at the economic numbers that will bear that out, and you could look at the social issues in terms of the tools that people use in power, to keep people who are not in power away from gaining any kind of progress. And I'm talking about the tools of voter suppression. I'm talking about the way that the media is used to basically portray those who are as some kind of criminals and what have you. Okay. So I could go on, but I see my time's up. Unfortunately, this is not a class.
Yes, Professor, we will come back to you. I do want to hear your story about your Jim Crow days growing up. But I want to, you know, there's a constant narrative throughout this campaign that Black male voters were not lining up behind Kamala Harris. But some have come to believe that's all a myth. And Dr. Andre Gillespie, Emory University Associate Professor of Political Science and Director of the James Weldon Johnson Institute for the Study of Race and Difference, is joining us this morning. Dr. Gillespie is an expert on African-American politics and has authored books on Barack Obama and Cory Booker. She's joining us from another battleground state, Georgia. Good morning, Dr. Gillespie. Thank you for joining us.
Good morning. I'm actually in the DMV today, but thanks for having me.
Oh, were you here for the Howard University?
Okay. No, wasn't there for that.
Okay. So what are your thoughts this morning? What's your reaction to what took place last night?
Yeah, I mean, well, you know, this is certainly a tough day for Democrats, and people are going to be thinking about what to do and what their next steps are. I think what we're going to be looking at is the variability of a number of different factors. So one, I'll disagree with Professor Barnes. The polls actually predicted close results. And so what we're seeing in the battleground states is that Trump is winning by 1 to 2 point margin. So he's not necessarily winning by tens of thousands of votes. North Carolina is the one exception where the margin is less than 100,000. But even when you have margins of 100 to 200,000, which is where margins are coming up in the other battleground states, those are still 2 point margins. And so if we consider what the confidence intervals were going to be for those polls that were coming out of the field at the end of last week, they were saying it was statistically too close to call. And when you have 1 to 2 point margins, that actually is about what we would have expected based on the polls. You know, you couldn't actually predict who was going to win the election. They could have gone all Trump as they did, or, you know, they could have gone all Harris and they didn't. We're going to be looking at variable differences in turnout. So right now, this election looks like it might have fewer ballots cast in 2024 than there was in 2020. And so we'll see how that actually impacts not just the popular vote share, but also thinking about how that affects the Electoral College vote. I just haven't had enough time to look at that data. I think a big lesson that we have to take from this is that, one, Black men, by and large, yes, they slightly increased their vote share for Donald Trump, but it wasn't the realignment that people said that it was going to be. And the increases amongst Black men nationally were offset by the increases in amongst Black women for Kamala Harris. And so I think we have to keep that in mind. That's something that I expect. You were making all of those prognostications about Donald Trump getting 20-25% of the overall Black vote, often on survey samples that had fewer than 300 respondents, sometimes between 100 and 200 respondents. So you're talking about really statistically noisy data that really wasn't saying much. So what I hope is that Black, you know, if you care about what's going on in Black and brown communities, that you'll actually invest the time and the money to actually carefully do research there. The one big outlier from a race standpoint is Latino men did substantially increase their vote share for Donald Trump. This huge gap between them and Latino women. And then I think the other story of this contest is if we look at the gender gap was more pronounced in Black communities than it was in white communities. And if we keep in mind that there are a lot of Republican white women, they voted for Donald Trump, and we should have expected that.
So you're saying the gender gap is broader in the Black community than it was in, than it is in the white community?
Yeah, I mean, and that's actually, this is not the first time that that happened. The same thing was true, you know, in 2020. It's not an unusual sort of phenomenon to have bigger gender gaps in communities of color than in white communities.
So you're saying that there were more Black men that split and voted for that did not vote for Kamala? What do you mean by that?
No, I mean, if we look at the percentage of women who voted for Harris minus the percentage of men, you're going to have a bigger gap in Black communities and in Hispanic Latinx communities than you are going to have in than you are going to have among white voters. So we're looking at, I think it's about an 8-point gap overall. Or an 8-point gap between whites, I should say, and you're looking at a double-digit gap amongst Black and brown voters. And so keep in mind that the baseline is higher in these communities. So overall, majorities of Latinx voters, and clearly overwhelming majorities of Black voters, voted for Kamala Harris, but you're seeing a much broader or bigger array of votes kind of sorted by gender between men and women in these communities. And so like when we think about the gender gap, when we think about this narrative that Democrats, that women are more likely to be Democrats, what the lessons of not just this cycle, but cycles that preceded tell us is that this is largely a phenomenon, or this is a phenomenon that is being driven, at least in part, by the votes of women of color, who are usually overrepresented in their communities' electorate because of things like felon disenfranchisement that take certain men out of the equation.
Mm. Now, I have a listener that's texting and saying that it was not a landslide. What are your thoughts about that? How would you characterize it?
The Electoral College, the fact that Donald Trump is going to get well over 300 Electoral College votes, I think he's going to be able to say that it's a landslide. And so we're not looking at a squeaker election where, you know, it's 275, 265. You know, he's going to get over 300. He's probably going to get over 310. Electoral College votes by the time it's all said and done. I mean, I think the other surprise, if there's a surprise of this election cycle, is the fact that it looks like Donald Trump might actually be poised to win the popular vote, which I don't think anybody expected him to do. And so in that respect, this was actually a pretty strong and decisive showing. No, it's not 1984, where Ronald Reagan wins 49 of 50 states. We're not looking at that type of drubbing, but like, he very clearly, you know, won and, you know, can credibly argue that he has a mandate from these results.
So let's look more closely at what happened in Georgia, because Black men make up roughly 30% of the registered voters in Georgia, making them the largest Black male voting bloc among the battleground states. And you're saying, did they turn out for Kamala Harris?
Okay, so Blacks make up 30% of the total electorate in the state. It's not just Black men. So it's Black people in total who make up 30% of Georgia's electorate. So it's 29.9% to be exact. My colleague Bernard Fraga did some estimation since the turnout data hasn't been released yet from the Secretary of State's office. In the early voting period, Black voters were actually underrepresented. So it was between 26 and 20% of all Georgians who cast early ballots were African-American. So based on his numbers, the total sort of Black proportion of the electorate is going to hover somewhere around 29.1%. So that means that Blacks turned out at almost their rate proportional to sort of how they their voter registration numbers. And so there's always going to be room for improvement, but that's actually better than it's been in some years. And again, if we look at the distribution of the vote, he's getting somewhere, Donald Trump got in the neighborhood of somewhere about 12 or 13%. I'm not looking at the numbers directly right now, of African-American voters. Keep in mind, he got 12% nationally in 2020, and I think the national exit polls put him at 13%. So it's not like he's seriously overperforming amongst African-American voters in the state. I mean, if we do look at the numbers, you know, broken down by gender, you know, you do again see the gender gap, and you do see, you know, Trump getting somewhere in the neighborhood of about 20% of African-American male voters. But those are not numbers that, you know, are unprecedented, I would say. And so, you know, if people want to talk about a realignment of Black voters away from the Democratic Party towards the Republican Party, it's going to take decades for us to figure that out. So if Republicans continue to make 1 to 2 point gains across successive presidential election cycles for the next 20 to 40 years, perhaps we can talk about there being a realignment. But there isn't a realignment. You know, Kamala Harris comes in, you know, between 85 and 90% of the Black vote. I think what's surprising is that as a Black candidate, she's not posting Obama type of numbers. We're in a much different time. We're in a much more polarized time in general that I think would have made that harder. And then we're going to have to factor in whether or not and how, if it's true, racism and sexism actually ended up depressing her support. But, you know, the truth is she was running as an incumbent, if you will, you know, for an administration that is deeply unpopular. So some of these things are explainable, even if it's a hard truth for people to accept.
Well, let's talk about that racism thing, because when the campaign issues were discussed, there was mention of the economy, immigration, abortion, and yet, while it was never actually said, I always felt like race was the unspoken issue fueling the campaign. We heard some people say, oh, I won't vote for her just because she's Black. But we never heard anyone say, I won't vote for her because she's Black. Although everybody knows that that's what was driving a lot of voters to the polls. Of course, we had Trump seeking to deny that she was a Black woman. And she never really came out and said, I'm Black. She just alluded to the fact that she went to Howard University and, you know, that she was a woman of color. How would you describe the way race actually played out in this campaign, Dr. Gillespie?
So, you know, it's not surprising that a candidate for president of the United States would try to transcend race, kind of in the classic deracialized Charles Hamiltonian sense. I think she tried to do that. She's doing it in really kind of complex and polarized political conditions. And we'll take that for what it's worth. You know, I think the question would be, since she wasn't the first major party Black nominee for president, right? I didn't expect that she was going to necessarily engender the same type of excitement that Barack Obama did, her gender notwithstanding, because of the idea that she's the second and not the first. And I don't fault her for how she responded to the ridiculous criticism that she doesn't identify with her Black heritage. And I think her surrogates were actually pretty effective in dispatching that. I think race was the text and the subtext of this campaign. We know from the empirical literature that anger is a motivating and mobilizing force for white voters in this country. And Donald Trump played to it. He played to their anger about inflation. He played to their anger about immigration. And he certainly played to people's racial resentment when he and J.D. Vance didn't hesitate to employ stereotypes, tropes, and sort of outright racial rhetoric to try to mobilize their supporters. And it worked for them. And so, you know, this is only confirming things that that people have been studying and have known about for years.
So it's kind of hard to differentiate as to whether it was race or gender that might have had an impact on white women. I saw one result, I think it was in Georgia, actually, where white women only came out in support of Kamala about 33% or somewhere in that neighborhood. What are your numbers? What are your numbers?
Well, I mean, I'll go back to the national exit polls. And so, and keep in mind that white women in Georgia lean more conservative and are more likely to be Republican than what the national numbers would suggest. What we see is that a majority of white women voted for Donald Trump. If we look kind of and we sort of peel back the onion a little bit and look at what types of white women were more likely to vote for Trump and which ones were more likely to vote for Harris, college educated white women are the only subgroup of white women that we can tell from the publicly released exit poll data that were more likely to vote for Kamala Harris. And so keep in mind that in general, college educated white women don't make up a majority of white women. They don't make up a majority of women. And so, you know, And these numbers are very, you know, are similar to what we saw in 2016 and in 2020. So there's a kind of a class as defined by status difference. And it seems as though most whites are still more likely to identify with and to vote Republican. And so, you know, this is still a challenge for Democratic candidates, as long as whites are, you know, still the numerical majority.
Mm. So how does that bode for the future of any other Black potential candidate for president?
You know, I think it's too early to say. I don't think this is going to dissuade any ambitious Black candidate from running for president of the United States. Kamala Harris clearly ran under some really unusual circumstances in terms of having to come in and replace Joe Biden after he'd already secured the Democratic nomination. I think, you know, it'd be really interesting to see how Vice President Harris's career unfolds after you know, the Biden administration leaves the White House. She put together a really impressive organization in the short time that she was the nominee. And so any concerns that people had in 2019 about her inability to organize and run a campaign may be dispelled by this. I think it would become a question, and we'll have to study this a little bit more to see whether or not people are risk averse, and thus do Republicans kind of go back and fall back on, you know, only putting forward straight white men because they think that that's going to be the most palatable to the median voter. So I think that that's a big question. But, you know, I think Kamala Harris still has a place in the party and still has something to say, and is certainly probably will be viewed in some ways, not necessarily as the elder stateswoman of the party, but certainly as an elder statesperson.
Okay, Dr. Andra Gillespie, Emory University. So Dr. Wilmer J. Leon III is the author of Politics, Another Perspective, and he's a nationally syndicated columnist and the host of Sirius XM's satellite radio's Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon. Dr. Leon, you're an independent, and you're also going to help us unpack the undecided vote. Did they decide yesterday? It appears they decided for Trump, by and large. Dr. Leon?
Somebody decided something. I guarantee that. Yes, I think I have not had a chance, and I feel a little better hearing Professor or Dr. Gillespie say that she hadn't had time to see the numbers, because I haven't either, especially in terms of the breakout of independents. When I was a child, my parents always told me, first of all, you have to be three times as smart, work four times as hard to get half as far in America because you're Black. And so I hope at some point in the analysis of this, we can move beyond the fact that Vice President Harris is a Black woman and start to look at the messaging and look at what the Democratic Party failed to do. Because it's one thing to say, well, her message was opaque, and then Harris have somebody say, well, Donald Trump didn't have a message either. Well, we know that. But that's not an excuse for not speaking directly to people that are paying too much for eggs, paying too much for tomatoes, and your only message is, an opportunity economy. What does that mean? That's not going to lower the price of eggs. So this is a multivariate equation. There are a number of factors that have contributed to the failure of the Democratic Party. I don't put this purely at the doorstep of Vice President Harris. This is a failure of the Democratic Party.
Well, okay, so I'm hearing a lot of anecdotal. I see where Dr. Gillespie, you had some statistics about independents that were put into the chat just now.
Oh yeah, the national exit polls gave Harris a slight advantage amongst independent voters. So I think the issue is it wasn't overwhelming. And I mean, we're gonna have to do some testing later on to see this, but Dr. Leon could be correct that it wasn't concrete enough for people. And so, you know, we'll have to sort of disentangle, assuming that these are independent of each other, we should be able to see the effect that the messaging had and also what the effect might have been on, you know, some of the biases and prejudices against Vice President Harris as a woman of color.
So now,
and let me also say, people say, well, they didn't want to vote for her because she was a woman. Well, Hillary Clinton won the popular vote. She got 66 million votes in 2016. She didn't win the Electoral College, but she won the popular vote with 66 million. Right now, it stands at Vice President Harris got around 66 million votes. Then people will say, well, I didn't want to vote for her because she's Black. Well, Barack Obama won twice. So, and this is why I'm saying it's a multivariate equation. I do realize that being Black and a woman is a big negative in the eyes of a lot of people. But if you just dismiss it as that, you will never get to where you need to be because you're not answering the substantive questions. And one of the things that I was saying to you on this show repeatedly was, where's the message? What's the message? And I kept being told, oh, that doesn't matter. That doesn't matter. Well, I think it does.
So the fact that Dr. Barnes, I see, did you want to make a statement there? No, I thought I saw you raise your hand. But you know, the fact that she was articulate, she did articulate her plan. You think it was vague?
No. What is opportunity economy? How do you operationalize that? When you say, oh, we're gonna force billionaires to pay their taxes, how do you operationalize that? Those are talking points. That's not policy. Her policy on Gaza was flat out wrong. She was part of an administration that started a war in Ukraine, flat out wrong. She's part of an administration that is trying to pick a war with China over Taiwan, flat out wrong. She never spoke to those issues, and those are issues that were resonating with a lot of folks. The Democrats were wrong when they did not allow a Palestinian spokesperson to articulate the Palestinian position at the DNC. That was a huge mistake. We'll look at the numbers and see if she loses Michigan, because I think Michigan is still being counted. If she loses Michigan, that's going to play a major part as to why. So the Democrats can't keep trying to placate to African Americans during the election, offer no policy to the Black community, and then expect us to turn out for them. That now, once again, is proving to be a failure. Where is the substantive policy? Because that's what elections are all about.
Yes, and I think you're right about Michigan.
How do you explain to millions of people voting for folk like Trump? Millions of people voting for Trump. Part of the problem is no one is putting any pressure on the American state. There is no civil rights movement. There's nobody out in the streets demonstrating.
Right.
So you think you can just win by giving a message? You think you can win by spending some money? You look in North Carolina.
I'm not saying that.
Equal amounts of money spent. They spent, both candidates spent basically the same amount of money, about $50 million apiece. They both visited the state 20 times. They both had basically the same strategy as far as winning the state. I'm sure they had the same strategy.
So if perception, states, if perception is reality.
One more point. There are so many people who don't vote who are disengaged from politics, period.
Why?
So to just focus on the swing states, I think, is the wrong way to go. What about those millions of people who are not engaged in the political process because we don't even put any time or money in trying to organize the millions of people who are not engaged in politics? You can look at every state and look at the percentages. They're like 40%, 30% of people don't even involve themselves in politics. You have to ask the question, why is that and what are the implications of that?
That's my point. Because if we're looking at this as an autopsy, as I understood, we're looking at this as an autopsy on the Harris campaign. Why don't those disenchanted, disaffected people vote? Because they don't see that the government in its current construct is responding to their needs. And what did Vice President, we heard so much in this campaign about, as Black people, we're supposed to vote for her because she's Black. We're supposed to vote for her because she's a Black woman. We're supposed to vote for her because she went to Howard. We're supposed to vote for her because she's an AKA. None of that feeds the bulldog. How is that going to motivate that unemployed auto worker in Michigan? How is that going to motivate that unemployed auto parts worker in Ohio, who, by the way, has had their job deindustrialized and sent to China? Where was the Democrats' message to those people? It wasn't there, other than we're going to create an opportunity economy so that anybody that wants, come on, really? Really? That's going to motivate somebody that doesn't have a job?
Well, we have to keep in mind that it was really close. Michigan, for example, is too close to call even at this point, I think. And I haven't looked at the TV since we've been on the air. It's a couple of percentage points. It's not too close to call, Dr. Gillespie.
At the end of the day, she lost. We can parse these numbers till the cows come home. At the end of the day, she's not going to be sworn in as president. The idiot won again. You can't beat Donald Trump. Oh, my God.
Do you think the independents helped to sway that vote? Do you think the independents and the undecideds swayed that vote?
Yes, they did. Mm-hmm. For a couple of reasons. One, they didn't feel like their issues were addressed. Two, because of a lot of people's disenchantment with the duopoly, they're trying to find another option and promote a third party avenue. And so a number of people heard something in Jill Stein. A number of people heard something in Dr. West. And they went that way. They decided, listening to this, Donald Trump is the devil reincarnate, time and time again. We know that. He tells us that every day. So tell me how you're going to make my life better. That's what politics is supposed to be about. Tell me specifically, other than platitudes like opportunity economy, and I'm going to give $25,000 to first-time homebuyers. How are you going to pay for that? You sent $8 billion to Ukraine 10 days ago. You sent $8.7 billion to the Zionist settler colony called Israel 10 days ago. And you sent $600 million to Taiwan. That's $17 billion that you sent overseas that isn't making the price of tomatoes any cheaper. Explain how that resonates with American people.
Just want to say, I agree with everything that John had to say, because again, people want to know what are you going to put on the bread basket? But the other problem is, which I mentioned before, nobody talked about history. Nobody talked about what happened 4 years ago when Trump was president. What did he do? And not only that, nobody talked about what was accomplished during the Biden. During the Biden Harris era, they accomplished a great deal, but they didn't talk about it. They talked about something that may happen. They talked about some concepts that a lot of people are not familiar with, as opposed to talking about what about the economy under Trump. You let Trump get away with the notion that your life was better under me than it was under Biden, and that could be no further from the truth. The details don't support that notion at all. Okay. So where was that message? It didn't exist. We're talking about fascism, which is a problem. Okay. We're talking about
absolutely right.
Dr. Gillespie wanted to make a comment.
Let me just quickly say, one, perception is reality. So there were a lot of people that believed that the economy was better under Trump. And the Harris campaign did very little in diffusing that myth. She didn't explain it in a manner that resonated at the grassroots. And the other thing is, I never heard, and if I'm wrong on this, then I'm sure you all will correct me. I never heard Joe Biden say, "It's hers now. What happened under my administration," like Bill Clinton did for Al Gore, when Bill Clinton came out and said, "Don't tar Al Gore with my mistakes. Al Gore had nothing to do with this. It was on me." That then freed Al Gore to go out, even though he lost. That freed Al Gore to go out and be Al Gore. I don't know that Joe Biden ever really relieved her or released her from the Biden-Harris administration.
Dr. Gillespie.
Well, I mean, so there are things that I will agree with and there are things that I will disagree with. One, I think something that Democrats are going to take away from this is that they're going to move centrist. So I think the move towards the progressive left is probably not in the offing here, because some of the frames that you presented aren't necessarily going to appeal to median voters. But, you know, the other thing that I would also point to is to look at the question about whether or not this was a person's first time participating in an election. And so about 8% of the voters in this election, according to the exit polls, were first time voters, whether they were newly registered or they, you know, have turned 18 within the last 4 years. They broke for Donald Trump. And so this suggests that the strategy of reaching out to low propensity voters was actually really effective on the Republican side. And so Democrats have some work to do in terms of finding new latent voters. I think some of the things that you're talking about specific with messages could actually be helpful. I don't know if it would have made a difference, because the thing that we're also not factoring into this right now is the idea that people are living sometimes in information and misinformation bubbles, where if they're consuming certain types of news, certain types of outlets, they're hearing and are bombarded with messages that are going to be really difficult to overcome. So yes, most people in the U.S. do not know that the United States economy is better off than our peers around the world. They just know that it was bad, and they remember things that they may take out of context, like stimulus checks. Which actually happened in both the Trump and the Biden administrations, but they remember the check with Donald Trump's signature on it, right? And so if they are misremembering it, and we do know that there are people who have this nostalgia for the Trump administration that doesn't necessarily resonate with what some people on the left remember, but like those things were actually factoring into their decision to make what I would argue are some really short-term kind of political decisions that could have long-term consequences.
But there were also
one last comment, and then I'm done. Electoral politics is something out of a major time. Change in America. You need pressure on the American state, what happened during the Civil Rights Movement. If you don't have that, then it's going to be the same thing.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Barnes. And very quickly, Dr. Leon, we're running.
Well, there are a couple of real data points that the Harris campaign was never really able to square. But in talking about how good the economy was doing, that's the financialized side of the economy. That's not the real economy. when they talked about unemployment being low, well, that's because people don't understand how the unemployment numbers are actually calculated. People make the mistake of equating job with worker, not understanding that there are too many people out in this economy working three jobs. So those numbers, because people don't understand what those numbers really represent, they are presented with a bad picture, because look at the unemployed, look at the unhoused in this country. For this economy to be doing as well as it's doing, go under any bridge in any major city and see how many people are living under bridges.
Yes.
Absolutely. Look at how many people are working three jobs just to be poor.
Yeah.
See, those are the realities that actually were in conflict with the message.
I see. Dr. Wilmer Leon, the third host of Sirius XM Radio, Inside the Issues with Wilmer Leon. We also heard from political analyst, author Robert Kramer, and former political science professor, Dr. Claude Barnes, as well as Emory University Associate Professor, Dr. Andra Gillespie. Thank you all so much for being our guests this morning on What's at Stake and helping us to unpack this very difficult day for Democrats throughout the country. And just wishing you all peace within. Thank you. Be well. But stay right there, if you will. Up next, did Arab Americans' protest vote help to sabotage the vice president's election? It's the economy, stupid. Or was it? And the Latino vote is starting to flex its muscles. We'll be back in a moment with hour two on What's at Stake. Thank you all for being our guests on this special post-election edition of What's at Stake. But stay where you are for part two of the special election.
Blues Alley is opening its doors to WPFW for two benefit shows on Wednesday, November 20th. DC's great guitars will feature three generations of players, Anthony Pirog and his wife and collaborator Janelle Lapine, Telecaster player David W. Chappell, and elder statesman Rick Whitehead. All playing solos, duets, and together in a full group. That's Wednesday, November 20th, two shows at 7 and 9:30. Ticket information is available at bluesalley.com/events.
This is Interim General Manager Miyuki Williams. On behalf of WPFW, I want to extend a heartfelt thank you to each and every one of you who contributed during our recent fundraising drive. Your support is the backbone of our station, making it possible for us to bring diverse voices, quality music, and important conversations to the airwaves. While we didn't quite reach our goal, we are so grateful for the incredible community we have in you, our listeners. And remember, it's never too late to show your support. Every contribution helps us continue our mission and keep WPFW strong for the future. Together, we can build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Stefan Lockridge, 15-year-old grandson of William O. Lockridge, awarded community activist, school board member, and teacher who became an ancestor in 2011. On Saturday, November 9th, 7 p.m., the William O. Lockridge Community Foundation presents the 14th annual Dancing with the Scholars. The event, featuring a dance competition with Ward 7 and 8 high school students and elected officials, happens at The Art on 1901 Mississippi Avenue, Southeast D.C. The Lockridge Foundation keeps my grandfather's legacy alive by providing college scholarships to Ward 7 and 8 high school students and biannually taking the students to Africa. For details, please visit William Lockridge Community Foundation.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
This is Dr. Ron Daniels, president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, with an announcement of a very important event, a national town hall meeting to assess the impact of the 2024 presidential election on the state of Black America and the Pan-African world. Progress or disaster? Thursday, November 14th, 6:30 p.m. sharp at the New York Avenue Presbyterian Church, 1313 New York Avenue Northwest in Washington, D.C. Speakers include Mark Morial, Dr. Julianne Malvo, Melanie Campbell,